I don't think, you know, they do say that they put off, you know, they stop the indigenous trees growing around them and whatever. So yes, I'm sort of going, I'm in two minds about thinking, have I done something that's really destructive? But then I'm given faith because it's full of birds already.
Yeah, there you go.
And it's but it would have been probably before. But, you know, I just think, I don't know. I think we're doing it as lightly as we can, Mick.
Yeah.
Mick would disagree.
We're going to bring
Mick would
Mick
say,
in.
Leave the bloody trees there. But then we would
Is
have had
right?
a... Yeah, we have had our disagreements about this area.
All right, let's mic Mick up and bring him in.
Yeah, bring him in.
Hey, mate, how are you?
Good, mate.
Yeah, so welcome, Mick. It's brilliant to speak to you too, mate, having seen a bit of your story in the film, obviously, and spoken to you a bit last night. So thanks for coming in.
Not a problem, mate. Not a problem. Lovely to speak to you.
And where you just have come into is a fascinating moment, right? Where the right ways to go. Part of the thing is that they're not so clear, as in that old sort of industrial mechanical frame where you just bang, bang, roll it, spray that, plant that, whatever.
Yep.
It's more of a mystery and you've got to sort of intuit your way through. But I guess there's a different mindset that enables you to tune in ever deeper into what the best way to go is.
Yeah, I think that's my starting point now is assume that I'm wrong. It's normally, if there's ever anything going wrong, it's generally either my mistake or it's a human thing. It's not something that nature got wrong. Mm. And that's...
It changes things, doesn't it? That with that frame.
Yeah.
Assume you're wrong.
Of course. It's your mindset, you know.
So you go more gently.
Yeah. And it's the, you know, me trying to communicate and learn what I've done wrong and learn to work more in tune with the natural world.
Mm.
I just have so much belief and faith in it. It's been doing it a lot longer than I have. What you know, and I just see our ignorance and arrogance of thinking, look at us go, you know, we're just so good at cocking things up and hitting the wrong target and instead of observing and being accountable. That's the whole thing, is just got to be accountable and observe what part you're playing in it.
It's really interesting to think about the fact that your old man's in the film too, right? And you've got this relationship where he's not convinced... You disagree on this.
Yep.
And I'm wondering what your take is on the barrier to seeing... I mean, he doesn't see any merit at all in it, does he?
You know, I've thought about this before and I'm sure they, you know, everyone has, you know, some understanding or... Huh. But they get, that won't work here, you know, or that people will say, that won't work here.
Because that was the received wisdom.
Well, let's have a discussion about it and you tell me what you think that is. What is that? Is it the fact that I'm doing something different or I'm not using a tractor or I'm trying to use... You know, there's a lot in that and, you know, I'm just learning that. There's so much in it, you know. And everyone's that is different, you know. What happens on my farm's different to what happens on the next farm. And even amongst regenerative farmers, you know, everyone's got a different that.
That's a good point,
mate. We're all trying to do better, you know, and understand it better and work with it. And
what was the change in you? Where'd that come from?
Well, a lot of people say they had a penny drop moment or a hardship or something, but mine was has been a long, you know, even from when I was working in amongst the coal mines, and it was just in the Hunter Valley, just a gut feeling like, this isn't right, you know, there's got to be something, you know, wow, what's the future in this? You know, yeah, it was a decent money, and there was some job satisfaction there, and you know, you could still take pride in your work, but didn't feel right, not like this does. You know, this feels right and there's a future in it. Ripping coal out of the ground doesn't feel like there's much future in it for me, or not for a long time anyway.
Yeah. So it was really more of a slow gestation.
Yeah. And I'd, you know, read things and listen to things and, you know, like my mentors and Joel Salatin, you know, I listen to his work and just how he words things and... Now that's honesty and correctness and good intent, filled with good intent, and just trying to do the right thing by the land and the people and live frugally. And
yeah, I love Mick's live frugally thing.
It's part of it, hey?
Yeah. And that, we're trying to teach our kids that. And our eldest daughter, she's, leaving home, and she's examining what I do and what Deb does. And I said to her, this is an intentional choice that we're doing. Deb likes bacon sourdough bread and hand delivering it to neighbours, and just being part of a community. And I love being part of a community and trying to build healthy environments. And that's a choice we're choosing to live that lifestyle. Yeah. That's what we want to do.
Yeah, because she said she couldn't, didn't she say, I can't do that, for I'm living in Newcastle and I can't do that. Yeah, I can't do that as easy. And you went, yes, you can.
Yeah, I said, of course you can. And you have to, everyone has to play their part. We're all part of a big whole, whether you live in a city or if you're a coal miner, we all consume, you can't blame anyone else. We all have to be accountable. We're all part of it. We're all doing it.
Now, this is part of the thing, and it's certainly part of my story, that this podcast isn't a farming, it's not a regenerative agriculture podcast. And this isn't just about farming. This is about everything, whatever field you're in, wherever you are. So it's really interesting to hear you coming at that as well.
Yeah.
And I guess in an explicit way too, hey, because you probably, as a lot of farmers are, acutely aware that being able to do what you do relies on the rest of the systems that interact with it, the market systems that we talked about a little bit before, the economy, which is even the way we would recognise health as coming from this and not from the pills after you get sick type of thing, the whole kit.
Yep.
This is something that you think about a lot.
My word, How does... a lot of time for contemplation,
It really motivates what you do.
Yeah.
I wonder how that bit's going for you guys, like that... And you talked about it in the film too, Rachel, which people will hear, of course, that the rest of the story is beyond the farm, where it does connect in with markets and people in their different lives.
Mm-hmm. The industrial world, the world, how most of that has worked for economies of scale, and how, where do we fit into that? How can we exist alongside it, or how can we infiltrate it, or that's the main thing for me with the documentary, is just bringing awareness that everybody can contribute in this space by choosing the power of the dollar and how they choose to spend that.
Mm.
Do they choose to spend it in some way that supports and props up a system that is working for us or against us in the end? It might be cheaper, faster, more economic in one way, but that is not sustainable.
So if we're
going to find the sustainable way, we need to really think about how we spend every dollar. And I guess people, young kids go to the city, and they are at their most consumptive time when they're buying, fast fashion and, buying at fast food stores, and they're supporting systems that are not supporting us. They're supporting the 1%.
Not supporting them, ultimately. Yeah.
Supporting the corporate, which, of course, lots of people have shares in those corporations and do very well out of it. But, if you want to support a system that's going to support you, support the one that's be really... think deeply about what is a system that's really going to support you in the end. Yes, it may be a bit more expensive to buy organic vegetables or regenerative meat, but it won't in the end, because actually it's a cheaper way of doing things, because we're just not using the inputs. We're not using, 100%. Nature is doing most of the work for us.
And you don't need the back-end healthcare as much, etc. You take out those costs, etc. Reparation of nature. Maybe, what are we going to do with...
It's so hard at this point to sort of balance it and to make the argument work so that, it's all right for you elites. It's all right for you that don't have to, that aren't on a really tight budget. I mean, we can't afford to have the regenerative, the organic vegetables. Well, actually, you can, because actually what you're spending by not having eating well,
yeah,
and the health implications about not eating well, we're all starting to now see very clearly that those are the things that are really holding us back.
That's right. Well, it's compound, right? Because I think as things get harder, and we call this a cost of living crisis we're in, but that's symptomatic of the systems we're talking about. So you can remain, and I know it can be tough. I mean, I've experienced plenty of it myself. I mean, I don't make much doing this, I can tell you.
Yeah, right.
But thanks to listeners, I'm getting by and can keep doing it for the moment, and we'll see where it goes. But I've certainly been aware enough in more recent times, thanks to others mentoring me, that if I can live in a way that stops the bleeding of costs in health repair and a car that I would drive around, you know, in a city with all the others, just idle half the time and then dormant 96% of the time when I'm not driving, that makes no sense. For one person to shoulder all that cost, you find the ways that you live more in sync. Strip all these. Well, it's the equivalent of the inputs in farming. They just strip all the inputs away. Mm. And then you find the leanness that you live by allows you to spend into the new world, if you like, spend into the new systems.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, in the 60s, we spent 60% of our income on food.
Exactly. And we spend 13% or something now, for example.
That's absolutely. So that's been a huge shift. And that's just gone to cheaper and cheaper and cheaper food. And, you know, I was talking to this guy who's a big wig moving in between the states and here, and I can't remember, he's in some agriculture area, and he was talking to some pollies over there, and, you know, they said, well, you just have to start making better food more available for people. And he said, well, the pollies just said, well, it's just a lever. We can easily pull that lever towards subsidizing food so that people get better food and we have better systems. But then you watch all the other people come down on you, all the, you know, the electronics people, you've taken the subsidies away from them in order to push it towards the agriculture. So you've got them all clamoring and going, we need the support, we need the we need the subsidy here. So you've always got to be pushing that lever so that, you know, no particular
realm
loses out, you know. Or so otherwise, least, they're all going to lose their jobs. Yeah. And
that's
all about holding the jobs, you know. So
that's another thing, isn't it? But but to the extent that is important, you're right. Or you hold, you move the levers in a way that makes it steady and that people are cared for in the transitions. We hear it a lot, thankfully, now in energy.
Yeah.
But the same thing in farming, arguably, and probably everything else. Hey, just what are the ways we can assist people to shift that don't leave them exposed? And there was a telling part in your story too, right? Where Terry McCosker calls it the valley of death. When you take, when you're sort of withdrawing your license from the old system and trying to go into the new, but you can be left exposed financially, let alone emotionally or whatever. Yeah. And you guys experienced that too, right?
And continue to, you know.
Really?
It's a, you know, but on
only
result,
because of the market. Only because of the market going up and
down.
This
is
that's
the point.
That what makes us vulnerable. But that would make us vulnerable whether we were doing it this system or another system.
You know, the
markets are always going up and down.
I still think the principles and, you know, there's certain principles that apply everywhere. It's like, you know, with the inflation and the power increases. Guess what? Use less. They're mechanisms that will, I don't care if fuel goes up.
Yeah,
I think
needs
that's,
to, eh?
We should be paying what fuel's worth. And that will drive change.
It's well said.
If there's proper accountability and things aren't subsidised, like electronics and whatnot, and they have to be accountable and pay for it, change will happen.
Yes.
If inflation and everything costs more, my solution is use less.
Yes.
Be frugal. People have to learn to use less.
Especially if it...
And be happy using less. You know, it's almost become a game to me now, to be a tight ass and use less. And it's fun.
The kids love it.
Yeah. The kids, well, Marley's starting to get it. The only way you'll, you know, if you use less, it doesn't matter if it's expensive.
You know, speaking of young people, there's a moment where you guys went to, I think, did you both go to the holistic grazing course together as part of this?
No, I went.
You went to catch
up. He was
on
farm. I had to catch up with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And Normie. They were very on top of it.
Yes.
They were all very on top of it.
Yeah, I'm still, I don't think you ever get to a point where you've
learned. But I needed the basics. I needed the basic stuff. So I did the holistic management one, which was fabulous.
That little snippet in the film, there were young people in that room.
Oh, I was easily the oldest person in there. Yeah.
So this is the other cohort
of
young people.
True, actually. There was a lot older. There was women my age, actually, in there. I went with a girlfriend who was my age. No, that's true. There was women. There was more women than men, of course. Why do I say of course? But they're good at learning. They're good at going, I don't know anything. Men are harder to go, I don't know anything.
Yeah.
And there's young people in the room too, right?
Yeah, lots of young people.
So it's not just... So there's this cohort of young people that are getting the message that aren't in the malls. And in fact, some of them, you mentioned Tom and Casey before, who we'll speak to as well.
Yeah. They're not in the malls, but there's still way too many in the malls and too few out here. And, you know, that's an ongoing conundrum is how they can afford land, how they can get their small plot of land. I mean, you know, the way Casey and Tom are doing it, they've got a pretty small area and they're just making that, you know, they're growing the most beautiful vegetables.
And they've joined with
others. Quite hard to get into cropping and to cattle when you've got no land. But there are systems coming up that are helping young people be accountable and borrow the, you know, rent the land. And also this thing of leasing.
Yeah.
You know, both Normie and Mick are very pro this whole just leasing.
Oh, yeah. As I drive around, and again, I don't drive far, but in this area, tons of underutilised land.
Mm.
It's about the owners being... Okay, leases are such a daunting thing for...
To owners, you're saying?
To owners, yeah.
Let alone to the ones
who... Because it's an unknown, because it can be confronting to put your name on something, but if they really understood, you know, what it was about, it's trying to make sure everyone knows where they're going, and, you know, I just see underutilised land for years. I mean...
Particularly around here, because people only have like 50-acre plots, or whatever.
Yep.
So there's a lot of people who just don't know what. I mean, like even like our mate Paul up the road, he's got he would have a 10-acre plot, wouldn't he?
25 acres.
Perfect for.
And I've seen
for renting.
Yep, I've seen leasing. It go for periods of 10 years with nothing.
Yeah.
No livestock, nothing. You know, 25 acres for 10 years. Someone could have been in there regenerating that land and making an income from it. It fireproofs that place. You know, when things, especially around here, if you leave land idle, it starts going back to timber and, you know, and I can take you for a drive and show you places that nothing's been done. It's almost a eucalypt forest in 30 years.
Mm.
And you can't have a house there anymore because it's such a hazard. When it dries out, you're gone.
Wow.
But if someone had been running a few head of cattle there and, you know, had an agreement, how about I look up? They've actually added value or kept value on the land.
Yes.
But that can even be with the land to market ecologically, you know, you can monitor that and go to the leaser and say, well, Here we go, I'm improving your asset.
Oh, this is so interesting.
You can measure that and show them that you not only that, they can still come there and use it and it's theirs and enjoy it. And people are doing it.
Yeah, there seems so much opportunity in that because whether you're talking even the First Nations collaborations again or Next Generation, if the barriers include lack of access to capital and land...
Mm.
And there's plenty of underutilised land. Wow.
Yeah.
It's a huge opportunity. It's interesting, isn't it?
Bloody hell, it's hard to make money on the land. I mean, it's...
So this comes back to what you said before, when you said the markets go up and down, you're exposed either way, in a way. Like, the commoditisation of this stuff, that seems to be something we're going to have to face down. Yeah. It cannot be that way for the right thing to be done.
No.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well... I mean, I think for the Casey Tom example is just fantastic.
It is. Yeah.
I mean, because it's a small amount of land and they are just developing their skills to be able to get the very best out of it. And they are making a living. They've formed a cooperative, not against that. Again, I imagine they're living fairly frugally.
Yes, they said that.
But, you know, it's about people who want a life of amongst the birds, amongst the trees, who get it being in nature, who are, you know, I just am so grateful that my mother instilled in me a love of it. Mm. You know, I mean, she would stop the car and go, look at that tree. Look at the way the shadow is falling over there. You know, my eyes were, I was awoken to appreciate it. She'd stop and go, what's that bird? Oh my God, there's a nightingale. Shush, everybody, there's a night, you know. It would be a sense of excitement. And that was, and that can remain very closed if you grow up in the city. You just aren't, that muscle of appreciation is not awakened. Yeah. We have it in the country.
Yeah, there's a lot of people.
You know, a lot of people who don't. And, you know, my sense of beauty, I just get off on of the beauty of what we're doing in the forest and the grass and the way that it's, I mean, everything is just breathtaking sometimes, isn't it? We drive out there and we're just like, oh, we're just made speechless by how beautiful it is sometimes, particularly when you go out early in the morning, mist is moving. He gets up much earlier than me, but I envy your moments out there.
But the afternoons are can be the same too. Yeah. Anywhere, anytime, there's always a miracle going on. But you know, what you just said, I worry about the disconnect. There's so many people living disconnected from that. Yeah. And a lot of our decision makers, I know it's going on. They don't know how dependent they are on these tiny little things that are happening out here.
Well, and it's not much to waken it. We've had school kids. We've had the number of school kids coming up. And they're, it's year six, right?
Yep.
I could not believe how many of them said, I love this farm. I love farms. Yeah. This is so beautiful. Yep. This view. They talked about the view and things. I mean, it was just, it's there. It's latent in them if it's allowed to come back. Just their level of appreciation. Yeah. They were not oblivious at all. No, they were absolutely clued into how beautiful it was.
Yeah. And that is saying something, isn't it? As distinct from, for example, this is part of why I started the podcast too. I was running events. Literally the last one I did that would get 200-300 people in Melbourne, because I believed, like you're about to do with your film, these conversations should be everywhere. So civic centres everywhere. Mm. And I'd been doing that for a while and it had built up. And the last one I did was Charles Massey with the couple from Wooleen Station over west when Rebaubler came out. But one thing that hit me was I thought, we can't just have... I mean, it's great that 300 people come to this thing, but we can't just have you guys coming to the city to do this.
Yeah.
People have to get onto the places, because this is what it... And I had to get onto the places because this is what it does. It speaks for itself. You guys add a bit of layer on top and certainly of your own story, which is how we...
But, you know, thank God for the Airbnbs. I mean, that's enabling people to really get out and come. Yep. Oh, my God, we have an Airbnb here. And I thought, forget it. We'll not go to anyone. We're down a dirt road. It's booked out all the time. Gone. And, and everybody's and everybody is around.
They're open to the signals.
Of course they must be. Otherwise, why would they want to go off track and go all the way back there and love the river and love the birds and love, you know, even though we got them up early the other day because the cattle were in the yards and they loved that.
You know what's really interesting to me? So Airbnb, because of my visceral experience going around the country, I've seen towns and communities emaciated because of Airbnb. Oh. Long-term families in regions like Northwest Cape.
Yeah.
Right. When we went there a couple of years ago, we spent a bit of time there and we couldn't find anywhere. We had to live in a bloody station caravan park over the side of the range. But more importantly, 30 families had really just had to exodus. And you're talking teachers and cops and stuff. Because central services. Because they were bunted from their rentals for Airbnb, where the owners could earn four times as much.
Yep.
They're not around.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Mm. Community's really affected. And this was true in the Kimberley too. Yeah. Like massive cafes and centres of gathering all shut.
Because they've all been taken over by the Airbnb.
Yep, well, owners have chosen Airbnb instead of renting to long-term tenants.
But then, in the end, surely there has to be the amenities that go with the Airbnb. So is there the coffee shop there, or is this just nothing?
That's the irony. Exactly. Oh, you're left with nothing. So you've come in.
Right.
But you've got...
Well, they'll soon die. Well, they'll soon die.
That's the thing. It makes you wonder. There's actually an alternative, an Australian person that's come up with an alternative. I think it's called... Might even be called... Wayfinder, actually, but I intend to speak with him more. I don't know how it works or how it's going, but to have learned more about its problematic nature, but then to hear this about the way it could be harnessed for possibility is really interesting.
Yeah, and you know, and this, doing this sort of farming too, we to make it work, you've got to stack enterprises.
Yeah.
You've got to have a couple of things going for you, I think, to make it viable, you know, and it is, you know, we're not making less than we were, for sure.
Yeah.
But we do need to have other things in place to just, when the market goes down, that there is something else that sustains us. Because we're small farms here. You're really dealing, and we've got one of the biggest ones, and we're only 350 hectares.
Yeah.
So, you know, people are on small acreage, and you can't make a living doing that on a small acreage. You've all got to have, have got to have jobs in
most
town.
Most people around here have got
jobs, yeah.
Yeah, farm
that's
income.
Part of the problem, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, for someone like me who doesn't farm, right, I think, okay, it's clear amongst all the patterns I'm observing, we need more farmers like you guys who are more in touch with things and in communities again that have been, you know, especially out west, I can tell you, just evacuated. To restore that is part of this dynamic, this regenerative dynamic we're talking about. And then to find ways that it's, you can make a living. Like when I first learned that farmers can't make a living, that's absurd. But the role that we're learning that you're playing for all of us in this way. So what do you guys think have come to think about the other mechanisms that are hedging at coming on board with, you know, biodiversity markets and carbon markets and so forth? What's your impression of those things?
In as far as the carbon things, we're too small to really make a big difference.
Really? So that can't even help at this scale?
I always want to put more carbon where it should be.
Yeah, of course.
That's.
But for you to get some recognition and value return, if you like, on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, at the moment, it's still quite expensive to actually measure it. Mm. And particularly in the most robust ways, like Terry does.
Like
and
Terry McCosford does, yes.
Yeah.
They're very robust ways of measuring, and that's expensive.
Yes.
So it's too expensive, really, for a farm our size.
To net win.
Yeah. Mm. But, you know, those costs will go down eventually, and it's always the pioneers that take the brunt and has to take the hard. I mean, for me, I think anything that gives a farmer a bit of subsidy, you know, we're one of the least subsidized countries in the world as far as farming goes, certainly in the in the Western world. So, I mean, we're very subsidized when things go wrong. So we're subsidized with farming, with floods and droughts and all of that. You get the same people having to get saved. So that's, in a way, it's like a subsidy. And we've taken our fair share of subsidy as well in those sort of situations. Mm. But
in terms of the general MO of regeneration, with all there is to gain with that, that's where there's not so much.
No. So if you can find any other way, like if you can get into carbon trading, I mean, I agree it's complicated. We don't want anybody just getting away scot-free with their pollution because of it. But I do see that, you know, if some farmers can survive, actually, by having these other things.
Yep.
The other thing that's great is these hip camps, too. Have you heard of the hip camp? Fabulous. So the hip camps are basically where you let people come in their vans and their caravans and their SUVs or whatever, or put out a camp, and you have a designated area, usually by a dam. People have their little areas. You can build a fire. So it's instead of being in a caravan park, which is very regulated, obviously, you come onto people's land and you can actually have your own space here. You can, you know,
there you go.
You can have your farm.
This is certainly what a lot of stations are doing now. So with bigger holdings, of course, but doing regenerative. I mean, it's sort of a different context. It's interesting that it's just got a name now, which I hadn't heard of.
Hip camp. Yeah.
And there is something to like about that inherently, hey, that an opportunity for livelihood in these contexts is to invite people in with all the effects it has on them that you were describing.
Particularly if you've got some water there. I mean, usually, of course, everybody heads for the beach, generally, in Australia. That's down to the beach. But there's some of us who would rather swim in a river with eels in it than go into the, you know, go to the beach. I mean, I would much rather have a fabulous dam and a river to swim in.
Me too.
Our Nambucca River is just so magical.
Well, just for me, who does prefer the ocean, but aside, I love what hits me is just a living landscape.
Mm.
That there's water in this living, and not too much. Like speaking of flood,
floods
and stuff that you guys have encountered after the fires. That it just looks healthy and alive. So just at that level,
I just love it for the life that's around the river. I mean, you swim in the river and there's ducks and there's butterflies and there's dragonflies and there's kingfishers and there's just such life all around you, which I don't find, obviously, when you go to the ocean, it's under you, but it's not, you know, you get a few seagulls. But when you're in the river, you're just surrounded by that life.
Yes, I spent time down there this morning. Absolutely beautiful. The verification process you alluded to briefly before and hammered the sign in up at the top of the driveway. Does that help? And this, for listeners, this is in the film, so I won't go into detail about it here, but does that help in terms of, I don't know, do you access a premium, or can you, could we imagine accessing community support in some way?
Well, again, you know, things are in their infancy, and we are still pioneers, really, in this area. So the markets and the and all of those things, which they are, they are essential tools, really, for verification in a marketplace. So for us, it's really about going, so it stops the green lighting. It basically goes, this is a very robust measurement of our land, and this is, and it is basically going forward in the right direction. It doesn't have to have reached the right direction, but as long as you can measure it so that you are increasing and holding water and building biodiversity and building microbes in the soil, you are definitely doing the right thing by your land. And but the issue at the moment is that the recognition for land to market for having an ecological verification outcome measurement is not known. One of them will probably come to the fore, whether it's that one or not, that people recognize. But, you know, I think people who are into eating well are starting to recognize those sorts of labels. And, you know, a lot of labels are green. You have to be very, you have to do your homework about them still.
Oh,
you know, 100%. You still have to do your homework.
Beware the green tick.
Yeah. And it's difficult if you're not selling. We're very much a breeding enterprise at the, up here. Mm. So we're not finished cattle. So really, it's for a finished market. It's for letting people know that it was great for us at the beginning when we were measuring to seeing if we were doing the right thing. Really essential for us to know we were moving in the right direction.
Well, that's where I see the added benefit of that was in me going out and learning with them, you know. And if I had to go and monitor this land by myself, it'd probably run into those sorts of figures anyway to do that that sort of detailed monitoring that they do.
Yes.
I reckon that's value for money. And if the name of the game is me having productive land and regenerating and having potential to earn a better income, for me, it's, I don't even care about it, the market end. At the production end, if I can be assured that I'm building our ecology, that's a win for me.
Yeah, I hear you. And I know there are good people working on what representations of that value that we need to value more are coming on and being experimented with. So it'd be interesting to see how they converge over time.
Yes, I mean, people are going to get fed up with the gaslighting, with the, you know, green lighting, whatever, what do you call it?
Green ticks.
Yeah. No, I mean, who can you trust? You know?
Exactly.
I don't know, this sort of, even the zero carbon farming. 100%. I don't know how you measure that.
What is the
zero carbon? I'm not sure. I mean,
Blair from Farmers Footprint Australia quipped to me yesterday, know thy farmer, when we were talking about some of this. Yeah. I mean, connection does seem to be it. If it's community, again, it's what we want anyway.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but a lot of people can't even begin to know their farmer. I mean, they're miles away from that connection. But you can know your farmer, but if you know your verifications, then you can, you know, you know that you're buying from the right sort of source.
Right. Yeah.
But they're not big enough yet. And of course, it's all in there, it's infancy.
Literally.
And it just, so everybody's taking a little bit of a punt on a lot of these things. And you know, and hopefully it will come to a point where, you know, things like this documentary will help to make people more aware, or to seek it, or to go, okay, well, where can I get? Oh, and the brilliant thing is with the Sustainable Table and Tanya Massey doing this brilliant thing of the mapping of all these regenerative organic farms, and where you can just go into your map and you can find your area and you can immediately find who is marketing beautiful paddock to plate beef, chicken, vegetables? I mean, and you can live like kings. You can yes. eat like kings.
Yes.
Like we did last night. I mean, there was just nothing in that meal that just wasn't straight paddock to plate everywhere. Yep. Bello beef, brilliant, and Mandarin Ben vegetables, and Rosie had grown her pumpkin. That was her pumpkin that she'd grown. And, you know, just gives it a different... And it's new for me. I'm still very buzzing on it. Yeah. I love that. You know, the fact that, you know, we know who our farmers are. We know what we're eating.
Oh, that's
we
what
know
it
where
does.
It's coming from.
Yeah, that's what it does. Mm. You know, there's a part in the film where Charlie, Mercy, talks about having expected this stuff might have come on more because of how infectious it can be. And he's spoken about this for a while, but he really is honing in on it, that there are power plays now, very explicit, holding it back. Mm. Do you spend time thinking about that and how that might be broached?
Yeah, I do think about that a little bit, but I still think you doing podcasts, Rachel getting this doco up, and the stories being told are going to filter out even to the producers. You know, if we're talking about profit, and this is the where we got it, if profit per hectare, once enough farmers and that have enough time to filter through, hang on a minute, these blokes like Terry McCosker and that, he's telling, you know, the amount of people he's influenced over the years and profit per hectare, you know, the principles that they're using to make profit and regenerate the land, you know, it'll filter out. It's getting there, and because people aren't silly, eventually they're going to realise, hang on a minute, I'm pushing shit uphill with a pointy stick, and we have to start doing it different, and there's principles that they're using, and people are working, you know, it's working for them.
And it is a habit, you know, is it something to change your habit, to really think about where you're, I mean, it's, you know, it's slightly more of an effort for me to organise, to go and pick up my meat box at... where it gets delivered from Bellingen, slightly more effort to sort of, you know, put my order, not really, hardly anything. It's just a different habit, actually.
Exactly.
Than just going into the supermarket. It's just a slightly different habit.
The effort is in the change, but then it's the new normal.
And that's the new normal, And, you know, people can do that absolutely as well in the city as they can here.
Yes.
You know, there is opportunity. I mean, Harris Farm is taking on regenerative meat, but basically is getting to know it is meat boxes at the moment. And the more people start to order those meat boxes, the more the status quo will be threatened, and the more, you know, actually we hope to go out of business in a sense, because if the supermarket starts to insist on this sort of type of produce that is full of nutrients and full of goodness and treats animals well and looks after the land, what's not to love?
Yeah.
100%. You know, what's not to love? And the more it gets, you know, the more we do it, the more people join in, the smaller the bigger the economies of scale, the cheaper we can make it. And but it's just a, you know, slow change.
Mm.
And
at that deeper level.
But you know, we haven't really felt it except for like our we came to a roadblock with our abattoirs, because all the abattoirs have been bought out
this
now.
Is,
so
yeah,
they're centralized abattoirs everywhere, they're miles away. Cattle have to go great distances to bloody get there.
Yeah, it's hard to know what happens there.
Yeah, hard to know what happens there. We weren't allowed to take our cattle to our nearest abattoir. They didn't want to do a specific, because they're all, you know, streamlined to go straight to their certain supermarkets, their buyers. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to do one that was on the outside going somewhere else. That was too much effort for them. Mm. The body, the weights of the body that they kill by. You know, it's all very regulated, and consumer wants the exact measurement of steak that they got last week. I mean, we need to embrace variety.
Yeah,
we need to embrace like the ugly vegetables. We need to embrace the non-perfect vegetables. I mean, very often I'll see an apple with a dent in it and I'll pick that up because I go, if I'm not doing it, you know,
right,
somebody else might not. And that's ruined, you know, but
exactly.
We've got to sort of stop this thing of wanting these perfect polished commodities, these perfect size commodities, these perfect tasting commodities. Beef, grass-fed beef, needs to be a different experience almost every time you eat it, rather than these absolute uniform ones.
And why wouldn't
you want to taste the soil in there. taste the different regions. Oh, tasting. This must be a... it's got a slight Bellingen taste to it. It's got a slight Wagga Wagga taste
to it. This is the funny thing, hey? We do it with wine.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's right.
It's a funny thing that we haven't...
it's cool in there.
Yeah, right on. Yeah. Yep, and you come to doorstops to have a sample. Yeah, so that it is a nice little reference point, I think, for the change that might be in play.
And I actually think there's value in a certain way. I mean, I know this virtue signalling is bloody annoying, but I actually do make a fuss. I mean, I do say when I go in and I want to have an egg and bacon sandwich, I know perfectly well that they don't know where that bacon is from. But I will always ask them,
same,
where's your bacon from? Same. And they go, I don't know.
Yep.
Why don't you know?
But they tend to then go ask the cook or the manager or something.
Yeah, and they don't know either.
They don't know either, but they're getting asked at least. Yeah, so it's still worth doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's on the radar.
Make yourself a pest about it. That's what I go, you know. Be annoying. Celebrate being annoying.
There's another pitch. So, Mick, will your old man watch a film?
Oh, I'm sure he'll watch it. Yeah.
Oh, that's gracious too, in its own way, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think he's looking forward to seeing it come out.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. And you managed, there's a relationship that isn't divided because of the difference in approach.
No.
Which seems important too. Not just for you, but for all of us to take that cue.
I think, as we've progressed, and I still have conversations and try and include and inform him and what I'm doing and why, and I'm getting better at discussing it with him, and I'm just getting better at having those conversations, not just with him, but with other more conventional people, and giving them the reason why I'm doing this. And it's tough, but this is what we're experiencing. And for so many years we've pushed it this way, thinking it was right, but it's actually not. We're making things harder for ourselves and less profitable. So if we're following nature's laws a bit better, because fuel's only getting dearer. These are these principles we keep talking about
that work everywhere.
And that's truly some of the only places that's what we can control, is how much you're paying to produce it. We don't have a lot of control over the market. And these principles will be working. And I explained to Marley, the daughter, the other day, about if you can keep your overheads down and not go into debt and live within your means, you can actually have a profitable little business. You don't have to sell, volumes, sort of thing.
100%. And
feel good about doing it. That's the cherry on top.
Well said.
Rachel,
you mentioned before, you're still buzzing with it. It clearly has enlivened you. I wonder, almost to come full circle on where we started with some of what triggered it in you, all this, what part of you it touches to do that, to have reignited your spirit? How would you put words to that?
God, that kind of makes me quite emotional to just think about it.
Yeah.
It's completely, I don't know, it's taken this darkness away from me, actually. It's sort of, and I don't know whether that was because I feel empowered. I feel I'm doing something about something that I felt very powerless to change. And that's been huge. Just to be part of something that I know is positive. And I I think it is the time of life, but I just cannot imagine doing anything I'd rather do than, like we were doing the other day, Mick, where we were just building bonfires and clearing some, physical labor, tired at the end of the day, exhausted by the end of the day, then... and seeing the cattle, even when we took you up and saw those cattle on the hill the other day, I mean, just magic, just being plugged into it and just being here quite quietly. I'm here a lot alone, and just the evening and watching the light and getting to know all my little chickens and guinea fowls and geese and the horses, it's heaven. It just is really a... It's an absolute delight to be here and to be able to make it. And it is very important for me, as I say to Mick all the time, it's very important to me that we make this work fiscally. You know, it has to work financially. We have to balance. We have to know that we have a viable business here, that this is not pulling our pud.
Which are broadly there.
No, absolutely. Yeah. We are. And if I was running, I mean, it's very different when you have a farm manager and normally somebody this side would be doing their own work on it, you know, and I'm a sort of a hindrance rather than a help most of the time.
Oh, come on,
but maybe. Yeah, that's right.
There's a fair bit of that. But anyway, you know, it bloody does work. Of course it works.
Yeah, of course it works. Yeah, it completely works.
And I see people also around here who are just having so enjoy it, joy of the community. I mean, we've got a new friend up here, Greg, who's just left work in the city and he just couldn't wait to leave his job and get back up here and start, you know, he's going to get into cattle genetics and he's doing the regen as well. And
that's it. And you're seeing this just, in your neighbourhood, that there's more take. In fact, you were saying it's probably majority of people around this little hood now that are taking that on in some form.
I mean, a lot of people really need culture. I find this is enough culture. This is culture for me. This is being out here. I don't really need to go and see the newest exhibition somewhere. Not really. But
you've had a big dose in your life of that too, eh?
Yes. Yeah. I guess so, yeah. And, you know, we get it coming, obviously, through our television screens. Get as much of that as you want, really.
Yes, it's true.
But to be in this world is just, you know, it is heaven.
Yeah.
It is. And I think it is the health of it too. It feels healthier. It feels positive.
Feels right inside. And if you could take a little bit of that connectedness that, you know, you're talking about and spread it around to everyone else that's disconnected, we'd be a lot, a lot closer to being where we need to be.
How would you describe Mick in you, the part that it touches most in you, enlivens you?
You've got to be connected and grounded. You know, that understanding that we're part of the system, not separate from the system. We're in it.
Yeah, and it's easier to feel it here, isn't it? It's easier to feel it on country, on land. I suppose people are born in the... I mean, you know, Brian was born in the suburbs. He feels very content and very connected in the suburbs. I mean, that's his world, so it's very much, you know, where you come from.
Well,
a lot of people feel very alienated out here, very lonely out here, yes, you know?
It's true. Well, one of those Indigenous people on the panel in Brisbane, her thing is really bringing a consciousness that country is everywhere.
Yes.
So connectedness to country is on offer everywhere. Yeah. And urban spaces is what she's working at because that's where most people are and where it can be assumed that it doesn't exist anymore, you know. But she's big on that. You guys, this has been a terrific conversation. Thanks for sharing it with me so openly. You won't know this, Mick, probably. I close every episode asking my guests to talk about a piece of music briefly that has been significant for them in their lives or perhaps even they're just enjoying now. And some part of me wants to give you the option, perhaps, to instead of a piece of music, talk about a film, even if that resonates. But music or film, something that's really been part of you, your spirit, if you like. Or, that you're just reveling in at the moment.
Well, for me, I was just... The music that I had for Beautiful Kate, my film Beautiful Kate, which was done with Tex Perkins and his Dark Horses band, just... I just go, wow, loved it. You're nodding.
Goodness.
It really was an exceptional soundtrack.
Rachel, it's actually one of the things I wanted to say to you while I'm here with you, but you've just said it for me. That is exactly what I think about. When I think of you as a filmmaker, prior to this anyway, it was that.
Right.
And the music, the soundtrack, wow.
Yeah.
That's
it was beautiful, absolutely. Well, I do love a dark, moody soundtrack.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, I don't listen. You know, I don't get control of the sound waves at my house much. but if I was going to say what's moving me most at the moment, it's actually a hand-me-down book that's gone through.
started out, it's probably Normie's because his writing's in there, and it went through Greg, and Greg's handed it to me. But it's a book by Johann Zietzmann, a Zimbabwean cattle farmer, and he's, what's it called? Man, Cattle and Veld. And it just sums up, you know, how we've got off track and how we, the way to get back on track.
Beautiful. Mm. Wonderful, you guys. Thanks a lot. It's been an absolute privilege speaking to you.
Good on you. Thank you.
That was Rachel Ward and Mick Green at Rachel's farm in the Nambucca Valley on Gambunya country on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. For more on Rachel, the film, the tour, and how to book your seat, see the links in the show notes. You'll also now find a link to chapter markers and a transcript. And I've put a bunch of photos on the episode webpage too. By the way, the Airbnb alternative I was trying to recall is Wayfarer. And as it happens, it's actually one of the recipients of funding from the WWF Innovate to Regenerate Fund that Damon Gammo was promoting when touring his film Regenerating Australia. Now Damon and co-founder Anna's team at Regen Studios is helping Rachel tour her film, starting in New South Wales, ACT and Victoria in July. Tickets are on sale from today. I know they're hoping to get around the rest of the country too, and if you'd like to partner with them to help make that happen, get in touch with Regen Studios. I'll put all relevant links in the show notes. And in true Regen Studios fashion, they've got many more links to go on with on their website. Come August, the film will be released in Australian cinemas nationwide. If you're interested in hearing more about the Sustainable Table Report that Rachel mentioned, tune in to episode 161. For the World Science Festival panel we talked about, go to episode 157. And for the story of the rainbow serpent at the Haggerty Farm in WA, listen to episode 143. And if you're interested in the next big regenerative agriculture event in Australia, join me in Margaret River, WA in September. I'm privileged to be MC and hope to see some of you there. Finally, huge thanks to Blair Beattie from Farmers Footprint Australia for taking the driver's seat on our journey south from the Northern Rivers to visit Tom and Casey for last week's episode and Rachel's farm for this episode. And, as it happens, an additional episode. Next we'll feature Rachel's daughter Matilda and her husband Scott, both of whom you might also recognise from screen life. We had a heck of a conversation about the regenerative flank they are bringing up beyond the farm. And that's all with hearty thanks to the whole family for having us at their place. For subscribers, I'll continue to send you behind the scenes stuff and other news of what's unfolding as I get around the country. And if you've been thinking about becoming a subscriber, I'd love you to join us. It's with thanks as always to this community of generous supporters that this episode was made possible. Just head to the website via the show notes, regeneration.com/support. And thanks again. And as always, please do share this episode and rate and review the podcast on your favourite app. It all helps. The music you're hearing is Regeneration by Amelia Barden, off the soundtrack to the film Regenerating Australia. My name's Anthony James. Thanks for listening.